From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We have achieved a victory. We say we will not go out until we get our justice, and we have it.
Today, Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis on Fire the Boss, the worker control solution from Buenos Aires to Chicago. We'll also be joined by a maintenance worker at the former Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago. In December, he and other workers occupied the factory after the owners gave them just 3 days' notice of the plant's closure. They won a settlement, and the factories remained unopen under new management. We'll also be joined by the co-author of Sin Patron, stories from Argentina's worker-run factories. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A coalition of healthcare industry leaders are now claiming President Obama substantially overstated their pledge this week to reduce costs. On Monday, President Obama stood by a group of executives and lobbyists from hospitals, insurance companies, and drug manufacturers at the White House and said they'd agreed to cut healthcare costs by 1.5% per year, or $2 trillion over the next decade. But on Thursday, the company said they never agreed to specific yearly cuts, but only vague voluntary goals. According to the New York Times, the director of the White House Office of Health Reform, Nancy Ann DeParle, initially said Obama had misspoke in announcing the pledge, but 1 hour later, she reversed herself and said Obama accurately summarized the industry group's commitment. The meeting was held as part of industry efforts to stave off a single-payer universal health care system. It's widely acknowledged a single-payer system would put insurance companies out of business because they wouldn't be able to compete with its cheaper costs. At a town hall-style event in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, on Thursday, local resident Linda Allison asked President Obama why the White House and the Democratic-led Congress have ruled out single-payer.
My question is, so many people go bankrupt using their credit cards to pay for health care. Why have they taken single-payer off the plate, and why is Senator Baucus on the Finance Committee discussing health care when he has received so much money from the pharmaceutical companies? Isn't it a conflict of interest?
If I were starting a system from scratch, then I think that the idea of moving towards a single-payer system could very well make sense. That's the kind of system that you have in most industrialized countries around the world. The only problem is that we're not starting from scratch. We have historically a tradition of employer-based health care. And although there are a lot of people who are not satisfied with their health care, the truth is that the vast majority of people currently get health care from their employers, and you've got this system that's already in place. We don't want a huge disruption as we go into health care reform where suddenly we're trying to completely reinvent one-sixth of the economy.
Obama did not address the second part of Linda Allison's question about Democratic Senator Max Baucus, who's excluded single-payer advocates from the Senate Finance Committee hearings. Allison says she was partly inspired to ask the question after viewing Democracy Now!'s coverage on Wednesday of the single-payer advocates who disrupted Baucus's hearing. You can view that at our website, democracynow.org. In other health care news, House Democrats have drafted a proposal that would require all Americans to buy health insurance and provide government subsidies for premiums to families with household incomes of up to $88,000. Employers would be forced to offer health coverage to employees or help fund it through a payroll tax. The proposal also calls for the creation of a new government insurance plan to compete with private companies. The proposed government plan would be run by the Department of Health and Human Services. The House has approved a nearly $97 billion spending bill funding the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. The measure includes $1 billion in military and economic assistance to Pakistan. Lawmakers stripped a provision that would have granted $80 million towards the closure of the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo. The final vote was 368-60, with a block of 51 anti-war Democrats voting in opposition. The Senate Appropriations Committee, meanwhile, has approved a $93 billion version of the bill that includes the Guantanamo funding but bars the transfer of any prisoners to U.S. soil. President Obama is expected to announce today plans to revive the military tribunal system for a small number of Guantanamo prisoners. Obama shut down the military trial shortly after taking office as part of his repudiation of Bush administration policies in the so-called War on Terror. According to the Associated Press, Obama will unveil new legal protections for prisoners in the renewed system. These include bans on hearsay evidence and evidence obtained through torture, as well as giving prisoners more leeway in selecting their military counsel. As a senator, Obama supported an earlier proposal for establishing the military commissions, but later opposed the final version approved by Congress. Human rights groups are criticizing Obama's reversal. Jonathan Hafitz of the American Civil Liberties Union said, quote, "There's no detainee at Guantanamo who cannot be tried and shouldn't be tried in the regular federal court system. This is perpetuating the Bush administration's misguided detention policy," he said. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is accusing the CIA of deliberately misleading Congress about the torture of foreign prisoners. Pelosi made the change Thursday in acknowledging she first learned of the waterboarding of CIA prisoners in 2003. Republicans have pointed to Pelosi's involvement in torture briefings to deflect scrutiny of Bush administration officials. This week, the CIA released documents showing Pelosi was briefed on CIA waterboarding in September 2002. But Pelosi insists she was told waterboarding wasn't being used then and said secrecy rules forced her to remain silent when she learned more details several months later.
The CIA briefed me only once on enhanced interrogation techniques in September 2002 in my capacity as ranking member of the Intelligence Committee. I was informed then that the Department of Justice opinions had concluded that the use of enhanced interrogation techniques were legal. The only mention of waterboarding at that briefing was that it was not being employed.
Pelosi has called on the CIA to release detailed records of her 2002 briefing. The CIA, meanwhile, has denied a request from former Vice President Dick Cheney to release full records of prisoner interrogations to prove Bush administration torture tactics yielded valuable intelligence. Critics have dismissed Cheney's call as political posturing because of the likelihood the CIA would reject his request. The Treasury Department's confirmed six major insurance companies are poised to receive billions of dollars in new taxpayer aid. The Treasury has given preliminary approval for giving assistance to Hartford Financial Services Group, Prudential Financial, Lincoln National, Allstate, Ameriprise, and Principal Financial Group. Hartford says it could receive up to $3.4 billion. New figures show a record number of homes face foreclosure last month. According to Realty Track, 342,000 homes received foreclosure notices in April, a 1% increase from March. Nearly 64,000 homes were repossessed, bringing the total number to more than 1.3 million since August 2007. The auto giant Chrysler has announced plans to close nearly 800 dealerships across the country, or one quarter of its retail chain. General Motors is expected to follow suit today with the announcement of 1,000 dealerships it plans to close. Taken together, the announcements could affect an estimated 89,000 workers. In Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinians marked the 61st anniversary of al-Nakba on Thursday, the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians during the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said Palestinians maintain their national aspirations despite more than six decades of dispossession and occupation.
We are clinging to our national beliefs, to establish our own independent state, with Jerusalem as its capital, and the right to return for refugees in the framework of a just and agreed solution based on UN Resolution 194.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, meanwhile, is set to meet with President Obama at the White House on Monday. In Burma, the pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is set to go on trial Monday for an uninvited visit by a U.S. citizen who swam across a lake to reach her home. The Burmese junta says John Yetow spent 2 days in Suu Kyi's home before he was captured as he made his way out. Suu Kyi's attorneys say Yetow ignored her pleas to leave and spent a night sleeping on a ground floor. On Thursday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton condemned the charges.
We oppose the regime's efforts to use this incident as a pretext to place further unjustified restrictions on her. And therefore, we call on the Burmese authorities to release her immediately and unconditionally, along with her doctor, and the more than 2,100 political prisoners currently being held.
The trial appears to come as part of an effort by the junta to force Suu Kyi to give up her home. She spent 13 of the last 19 years under house arrest. Back in the United States, the Houston-based spiritual leader Sheikh Zubir Bouchiki has been released on bond after 4 months in a private immigration jail. Imam Zubir has lived in the United States for the past 11 years. He was jailed in December after U.S. immigration authorities rescinded his green card approval and rejected his application for permanent residency status as a religious minister. Immigration officials arrested him at his home and led him away in handcuffs in front of his wife and 4 children back in December. I interviewed Amir Zubir last month after he called in from the private jail.
I strongly believe that I am targeted because of my political views, especially I was against the war in Iraq, against the bombing innocent civilians in Lebanon in 2006, and for my clear stance that I am pro-democracy and values that this country was founded on. And they don't want somebody who is free-minded and outspoken.
Imam Zubir's release follows a grassroots campaign to pressure immigration officials to set him free. He's out on a $20,000 bond. And in New Hampshire, Governor John Lynch has vowed to sign a bill legalizing gay marriage. State lawmakers passed the measure earlier this month. Lynch says he'll endorse it after legislators make changes to protect churches from lawsuits if they decline to officiate over gay marriages. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. With the nation's unemployment at 8.9%, the highest it's been in over 25 years, workers across the country are fighting in a variety of ways to keep their jobs. Nearly 1,000 workers at the Chicago-based apparel firm Hart, Schaffner & Marks, or Hart Marks, recently voted to sit in to save their jobs in an effort to prevent Wells Fargo from liquidating the factory. In December, at the Republic Windows and Door factory in Chicago, workers occupied the factory floor after the plant's owners gave employees just 3 days' notice of the plant's closure. The workers ended their six-day occupation after winning a settlement securing the reopening of the plant under new management.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Armando Robles, a union leader and maintenance worker at the former Republic Windows and Doors factory. But first, we turn to journalists Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis. In 2004, they produced the documentary The Take about workers in Argentina taking over the factories abandoned by their owners. Naomi's author of a number of books, including The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and No Logo. Avi Lewis is the host of the news show Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English. They're speaking tonight at Cooper Union here in New York at an event called Fire the Boss, the Worker Control Solution from Buenos Aires to Chicago. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Naomi, before we go into these various takeovers from Argentina to Chicago, your comment on the latest situation with the banks, we haven't seen you since, well, soon after the various bailouts.
And they're ongoing. I mean, I wish things had gotten better since we last spoke. And I think I called the bank bailout the biggest heist in monetary history back then, and it's just gotten bigger. We've seen just an absolutely unprecedented transfer of public wealth into private hands. And you know what I've been saying from the beginning, I think it's becoming even clearer now, which is that the crisis in the financial sector is not being solved, it's being moved. A private sector crisis is being transformed into a public sector crisis in the sense of the huge deficit that's being left behind because of this bailout, which isn't even doing what it's supposed to be doing in terms of restoring credit and fixing the real economy. So the price of this is, if it isn't fixed, is going to be paid in cutbacks to healthcare, to Social Security. We haven't felt the full shock yet. And that's my concern. Yes, I'm concerned about what's going on now, but I'm concerned about how this transfer of wealth is going to be paid for down the road in terms of the meager social services that Americans get in exchange for their tax dollars.
And yet you're seeing now, at least in the stock market, the bank stocks, as well as some of the others, are at least leveling off, beginning to rise again, even as unemployment continues at record levels, new people that are thrown out into the street every month.
You know, and during the election campaign, you know, I think what Obama articulated so well is the fact that people realize that what's good for Wall Street isn't necessarily good for Main Street. And he said, you know, we've had this top-down approach, giving more and more to the people at the top, waiting for it to trickle down. And he promised that that would change. Quite the contrary, what's actually happened is that homes, jobs have been sacrificed in order to stabilize the financial sector. So what I'm really worried about is that what we're seeing, if this quote-unquote works, and of course that's up for debate, and we have some very respected economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman who have, you know, said very clearly that they don't even think this is going to save the financial sector, that, you know, we haven't even addressed the depth of that crisis because we don't even know the extent of the toxic debts. But even if it does work, you know, even if we suspend disbelief and believe that it does work, what I'm worried about is that this is the new normal, that the banks are being saved on the backs of union workers, on the backs of what's left of the manufacturing sector, on the backs of homeowners. And so what becomes the new normal after the crisis is an even more deeply divided country, an even more deindustrialized country. And that's why we're highlighting tonight in this event that we're doing at Cooper Union and bringing in workers who are on the front lines of this struggle to tell their stories of how they're trying to save their workplaces, is that, you know, we need to address this now because we don't want this to be the new normal.
It seems I wanted to ask you, because you seem to be focusing more on how workers and ordinary Americans can respond themselves. But we've seen, for instance, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, launched this huge corporate campaign against Bank of America to get the union and citizen groups to get involved in trying to a shareholder revolt to remove Ken Lewis. And I reported the Daily News that SEIU, while it was doing that, was also increasing the amount of money it personally, the union, was borrowing from Bank of America.
Yeah.
This effort to direct the struggle towards shareholder actions rather than actual grassroots organizing in these communities?
Well, you know, that's why I think that the case of the Republic Windows and Doors Factory is so interesting, and you know, looking forward to hearing from Armando later in the show, is that I think it is really important for the labor movement to talk about the injustice of the bailout, to do a huge amount of popular education. But for me, it's less about changing the CEO at the top and more about highlighting the incredible double standards. And that was why the Republic Windows and Doors occupation became not just a national symbol, but an international symbol, because the workers in that factory, with their union leadership at UE, which is a, you know, smaller, very democratic union, decided that they were not just going to highlight the actions of their bosses, the owners of their factory, but the actions of Bank of America in the fact that they had gotten bailout money and that they had refused a line of credit. So here you had, you know, the country in an outraged over the fact that so much taxpayer money had gone to these banks in the name of increasing credit, and then they're finding out that the banks aren't actually lending. But here you have this very concrete case where the banks didn't lend to a workplace that needed it. The workers were paying the price. And so here you had the sort of injustice, the double standards of the bailout, and their slogan, you got bailed out, we got sold out, you know, in microcosm. So I think that, to me, that is a much more, a better use of the targeting of the banks than changing going after the, you know, the CEOs at the top. Because I think we have this illusion that when you change the CEO, then something as deep is happening. And that becomes almost synonymous with re-regulation, which is what we really need in the financial sector. And if we think back to the 30s, you know, in FDR's first 100 days, he got Glass-Steagall passed. We've seen no serious re-regulation of the financial sector. And so when we just focus on changing the leadership and that kind of shareholder activism, I think we have the illusion that there is a sort of real re-regulation going on in the financial sector, and it's just not happening. And that's what we need the labor movement to be saying.
Well, before we go to Chicago and Argentina, Avi Lewis, I did want to ask you about, the industry that isn't getting quite as much as the banks. That's the auto industry. And you're just back from Detroit. Chrysler announcing plans to close, nearly 800 dealerships, a quarter of its retail chain. General Motors is expected to follow suit today with closing 1,000 dealerships. Taken together, it could mean something like 90,000 workers will lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just spent a week in Detroit doing the latest episode of Fault Line on the auto crisis and the way it's being experienced on the ground by workers in where the auto sector used to have its home. What's fascinating about what I learned that is not being talked about right now has to do with the financialization of the auto sector and of all American corporations, and the way that that is now taking a real hit out on working people. So you have in the stress test, remember, one of the biggest insolvencies that was revealed was the financing arm of GM, GMAC, which has an $11 billion hole in its balance sheet, which the public is going to backstop, which we're going to pay for. Because, and this is what's not being told, GM, the credit arm and the Ford credit arm and different degrees, and Chrysler's too, were gambling in derivatives because there were super profits to be made when the bubble was being inflated. We have a lack of productive investment in the auto sector, which has been going on for three decades, while they've been financializing. So you see immediately the Treasury Department is prepared to bail out the financial arm of GM, while GM and Chrysler are both being forced into bankruptcy. So not only do you have the financialization of the sector and the bailouts for the financial arms, which dwarf the others, you also have the logic of the vulture capitalist at work in the auto sector. Why are they being driven into bankruptcy? Why is there such a rush to go into the bankruptcy process? I interviewed Ralph Nader, who's been following the auto industry for a little while now, and he said that basically it's about driving, it's speculative capitalist logic to drive the companies down to get to squeeze what can be squeezed. Unemployment and layoffs always rise a stock price to cash out on the bounce back. If you look at the auto industry task force that President Obama has appointed, there's no one from the auto sector there. Most of them are investment bankers, and they're looking at this as a classic corporate restructuring where you're focused on the share price, where you're focused on the bounce back, where you're getting billions of dollars of public money. Jobs are just simply not the focus there. So the auto industry is subject to some of the same special treatment when it comes to the financing arms, but to a very different standard when you're talking about the actual workers. And so that's why we've seen worker occupations in the auto sector too. In Canada, there have been four plant occupations in the last 4 months, I think. All of them plants that were closed suddenly and abruptly without the proper notification, severance packages which are up in the air, maybe drifting away, and workers leaping to their feet in this moment and saying, wait a second, there's trillions of dollars of public money which is being funneled to certain kinds of businesses. Where's our bailout? That's a powerful call.
But yet, some of the Republican critique of the bailout crafted by the Obama administration of the auto industry is that Obama is favoring the unions and the workers, and in essence now the UAW will end up, for instance, in the Chrysler situation as one of the main owners of the new company.
Well, now we're talking about health care. Now we're talking about single-payer health care, and I'll tell you why. It costs the big three $1,500 more per car in health care costs alone than their rivals, who are either working in countries like Canada that have universal health care, who aren't subject to those costs like the Japanese automakers.
So they pay more for health care than they pay for steel.
Exactly.
They can't compete with the foreign companies,
right,
because they're from countries that have single payer.
Right.
And you're from Canada, which is very interesting. You have an interesting perspective.
Well,
one
of the reasons that the auto industry has been so strong in Canada all these years is that, you know, it's so much cheaper for the big three to do production just over the river, you know, in Windsor from Detroit, because those health care costs are covered by society rather than by the companies. So when we talk about the UAW owning half of the new Chrysler or half of the new GM, we're not actually talking about worker ownership, or let alone worker management. They'll only get one seat on the board. What we're talking about is the $20 billion, for instance, that GM owes to workers in healthcare obligations. They're getting half of that in cash, and they're getting half of that in stock of the next company. So the union is gambling that the new company will do well enough that it will be able to honor the healthcare obligations to its own workers, which GM always had contractually, which the union exchanged and agreed to manage as part of decades of concessions. And now it's the United Auto Workers Health Fund which will own half of the new company. That's a gamble that the new company will be strong enough to pay for healthcare obligations, which should have been universalized a long time ago.
You know, I just would just add, you know, that clip that you played earlier of Obama saying, you know, we're not starting from scratch. True, no country is ever starting from scratch. But when you look at the way all of these various crises are interrelated, the healthcare crisis with the financial sector crisis, with the manufacturing sector crisis, you could not imagine a moment which was more ripe for possibility of actually stepping back and going, this whole thing is broken. How do we rebuild this in a way that makes sense? There's not going to be another moment like this, Amy, you know.
And that's interesting that they're not questioning nationalizing the debt of and bailing out these banks and these other companies like AIG, but they question nationalizing the cost of health care, which involves everyone.
Yes, that's the that they agree with the Republicans. That would be socialism. So yes, it's true. Avi and I are from a socialist, the socialist country of Canada. Would that it were so.
We're talking to Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis. Avi works at Al Jazeera, does a broadcast called Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English, and he is the director of The Take, which Naomi Klein made also about Argentina. When we come back, we're going to go to Chicago to find out about the takeover of a factory, and we'll also be going to Argentina. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Oh, that, by the way, was Pete Seeger. Which side are you on? Pete celebrated his 90th birthday with, 18,000 people at a small garden party, Madison Square Garden, on May 3rd, on his actual birthday. We're going to go to Chicago and then to Argentina to look at these takeovers of plants, our guests Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis. But Avi, can you just give us an overall summary of what's happening with these plant takeovers around the world?
Well, I mean, as much as financial bailouts and financial crisis gets covered, we get unemployment numbers, we get fewer faces, but the crisis is people are losing their jobs in staggering numbers around the planet. And we're starting to see the kind of pushback and the kind of worker fight back that we saw in Argentina after the economic crash there. And that led to a whole new movement of worker-run businesses. I've been tracking some of these developments, and many of them will be familiar to your viewers and listeners. But just so you know, in Argentina, just in the last 4 months, they've had more worker takeovers of businesses in the last 4 months than they had in the previous 4 years. And this is the country which is the leader in worker takeover of the means of production. In the UK, you have the Visteon auto plant, which was there are three plants spun off from Ford in 2001. The workers there got 6 minutes' notice that their workplaces were closing. I mean, in Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago, they got a few days. They got 6 minutes in Visteon. So hundreds of workers did a sit-in on the roof of their plant. They were hard bargaining for about 10 weeks. They ended up with a severance offer that was 10 times what they were initially offered. So that's a huge victory, although there's still a lot of mistrust between the workers and the equity fund, which they're negotiating with. So they're not over there. The famous Waterford Crystal plant in Ireland by Wedgwood China, owned by Wedgwood China, was occupied by 7 weeks earlier this year. It had been taken over by a U.S. private equity firm. So there's a lot going on in Europe around the foreign takeover of their production capacity. I mentioned in Canada there have been auto plant occupations. In France, there's been this wave of boss nappings where workers have been holding their bosses hostage in the workplace after sudden takeovers.
Don't get that publicized.
Well, you know, but the thing is, it's France. So, for instance, when they held the chief executive of the plant in the 3M plant in France, they brought him moules et frites. They brought him mussels and French fries for dinner. So there's a level of civilization in the boss nappings there. But Caterpillar and Sony and Hewlett Packard and other multinational corporations have faced this boss napping technique. And then we have in Poland just this week. the largest coal coking producer in all of Europe. Thousands of workers bricked up the entrance to the company headquarters because their wages have been cut. And then we've seen Republic here in the United States and the Hartmark story. This famous, legendary suit maker has been in business more than 120 years. They made Obama's suit that he wore on election night in Chicago. They made his tuxedo that he wore for some of the inauguration balls. And they are now facing bankruptcy at the hands of Wells Fargo, which has received $25 billion of public money. So we see this dynamic playing out in different ways in different countries. But there's no question that there's an international wave of pushback. And the question is, where is it going? What forms will it take? And how do we talk about it in a way that formulates it as constructive alternatives to this economic crisis that are coming from below because the bailouts have all been top down?
One point I'd just add about Wells Fargo and you know the suit factory in Chicago is just, you know, here we're once again seeing the lack of logic in the way this so-called bailout is being run, because there's been, even though, you know, the right is constantly calling the Obama administration socialist, what we've actually seen is an absolute unwillingness to use the power that they should be getting by bailing out the banks to restructure the sector. And, you know, when you see these banks getting bailout money and not supporting factories that, you know, at least in theory, this administration wants to protect manufacturing jobs. They ran a campaign saying we're going to do this. Now, if you accepted your responsibility that comes from bailing out these banks, then you could actually have the power to direct those banks to lend money, to issue credit in the interests of your other priorities, right? And so that would be true for homeowners, and it would also be true for these factories that are being closed. So, you know, there is this, I think it's really important for us to understand that the Obama administration is still, you know, in the grips of this laissez-faire ideology, even as they break the core rules by intervening in the economy in such dramatic fashion. They're intervening, but at the same time, they're saying, well, we don't want to run the banks, you know? So you have a situation like Citibank, which is worth, I think, the last I checked, $21 billion on the books, but yet $45 billion of taxpayer money has gone in. So by all rights, you know, American taxpayers should own Citibank more than twice over, which would mean they could direct Citibank to issue credit in the interests of taxpayers, in the interests of the public. But clearly that's not happening, or these factories wouldn't be closing.
But and all this money seems to be going from government guarantees or direct loans to the banks, yet you're not seeing a situation where, for instance, now Congress has already caved in on being able to pass legislation that would allow judges to renegotiate situations where homeowners were facing foreclosure, and you're not seeing the money go to the people who need it. It's being spent largely, it seems, on paying off the derivative contracts that have gone bad.
Dick Durbin said it best. He said, you know, the banks still own this place, right? I'm referring to, you know, Congress and the Senate. And what's so extraordinary about that is that Americans should own the banks, right? Because they paid for them. Now, if that happened, then they could actually own their own government again. Wouldn't that be revolutionary?
No, maybe the missing ingredient here is the media to be asking these critical questions. I mean, who is holding those who are being bailed out and those who are bailing them out to account?
There's no question that there's a huge opportunity here, which is being missed by mainstream media. But that's not earth-shaking news to viewers and listeners of Democracy Now. What's interesting, though, is that workers in many cases now are giving the media a story. And one of the incredible things about the Republic Windows and Doors story didn't happen in Argentina in the wave of takeovers there. It happened subsequently as films like The Take and others made the rounds and people learned about what was happening there. You get worker-led constructive alternatives, which are so dramatic and so different that then they get coverage, and then you have media being forced to take notice.
I want to turn now to Chicago, where workers at the Republic Windows and Door factory occupied their plant in December after the plant's owners gave workers just 3 days notice of the plant's closure. This is an excerpt of a documentary produced by the workers' union, United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America.
They gave us like an hour, more or less. They came and said, okay, time, you have your papers, now go. That's when we said, no, we're not leaving. This is where we're staying.
So we decided, we just said, well, hey, we're going to stay here until, you know, y'all give us some better answers than this.
He said quit it! He said quit it!
This is a group ready for a fight.
We put it to a vote, and workers decided that they will be staying in the plant for the remainder of the weekend.
More than 200 of Republic Window and Doors' 300 union workers are staging a sit-in of sorts until they get what is legally owed to them. The union says company officials told employees they were closing shop because Bank of America would no longer extend Republic a line of credit. Bank of America wouldn't confirm that due to confidentiality concerns. Workers say the fact that Bank of America received $25 billion in the federal bailout makes this even more unacceptable.
I'm going to stay until the end. If they told me I have to leave, well, if they have to arrest me.
You're prepared to be arrested.
I'm prepared to be arrested if it's necessary.
No nos vamos. Aquí estamos.
Translation, we are here and we are not going anywhere.
We've been here overnight. We've been here since yesterday and we aren't going anywhere. We are committed to this.
Melvin Lackland is one of dozens of Republic Windows and Doors workers who is staying put in the company's cafeteria until he gets his remaining vacation, health care, and severance pay.
You got bailed out!
We got sold out!
These workers, if they have earned these benefits and their pay, then these companies need to follow through on those commitments.
Workers all around the nation who are now facing massive layoffs, it's your job, it's your plant. Stay there and fight for them until justice comes, and justice will come.
What I saw inside was that people were very excited. They came to me and they said, Rosie, Barack Obama said that he's impressed with us. And we're so happy to know that the people on the outside hear us, and we have their support. And all that support that we got, it made us stronger. And it made us realize we had to stay. We couldn't give up the fight, and we would keep fighting until we won.
Bank of America, it struck a chord in me because the first thing that they said was, remember, we are an organization that's here to make money. That was the first thing that they said. You are here to make money. Okay, then wouldn't you make money, make more money by keeping us open? You know what I'm saying? You would think, I mean, because we didn't need a whole lot of money. We needed money for day-to-day operations. This bad press is coming into place, and you're starting to lose money, and you stand a chance of now losing billions of dollars, as opposed to 1.75 million. Now you want to step up, you know, which is a good thing, you know what I'm saying? And so, then now they wants to help. Now they're saying, well, our only concern is for these workers. Wow. Where was the concern before the publicity? You know what I'm saying? I mean, and it wasn't just the Bank of America here. It was their branches all over. It was amazing. I couldn't have dreamed a better dream.
The occupation is over. We have achieved a victory. We say we will not go out until we get our justice, and we have it.
Yay! Excerpts from a video produced by the Workers Union, United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America. Armando Robles is the last person you saw in that video, and he's joining us here in the Firehouse studio, president of Local 1110 of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America in Chicago, maintenance worker at the former Republic Windows and Doors factory. The latest news, and welcome, Armando.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to me being here in United Now and Democracy Now.
Could you tell us a little bit about what's happened to the factory since? There were reports about a couple of months ago that a new buyer came in and is reopening the factory.
Yeah, in December, the end of December, I received a call in the union hall from a guy from California. And he is interested to buy Republic Windows and Doors facility. And we have an agreement to bring him to Chicago. We show the company, and we introduce him to the government and the bank to start dealing to the possible buying. And like a month and a half, they conclude the buy. We have our, we negotiate our own contract for 4 years, and we go down, go forward with this.
And how many of the workers have returned to the factory?
Right now, our 10 workers, because we don't have a lot of sales right now. We expect starting getting sales to rehire the 275 workers.
You said you were willing to risk arrest. You would stay in the factory. Why?
Well, because it was for to support my family. To going out to find another work, it takes time, and it was my last play, which I had to do it before going out and resigning.
Were you surprised by the enormous support you got from around the country and the enormous attention that the sit-in generated throughout the United States?
Right now, yes. Before, when we started, we don't believe in that's gonna be the, that intensity is gonna take this. But right now, I wake up from.
It's been a bit of a dream, hasn't it?
Yes.
Have you been in touch with the Hart Marks people, the factory that made the suits for Barack Obama and his tuxedo that is being closed by the TARP bailed out Wells Fargo?
Yeah, well, we sent a crew of co-workers to talk with them. And unfortunately, I was working, but I'm in touch with that. And I feel great that this happened because it's bad to how the people is going out of unemployment, and it's hard for all the workers.
There's something going on in Chicago, you guys. This, and it's powerful to have two examples in one city, because it's powerful what the Republic Windows and Doors workers did. Now, Serious Materials Workers, I guess. Is that what you're going to be called?
That's
the new company. Maybe they'll have a new name. But the, you know, so many of the worker struggles that we've been seeing around the world in this moment of crisis have been for people to just get their severance pay. Because all of these factories are closing abruptly. Companies are using the crisis as an excuse to shed jobs and to close facilities. And so much worker energy has been mobilized just to get the last paycheck. But what happens to those people after that? What the Republic Windows and Doors struggle shows, and what all of these recovered companies in Argentina show, where they're actually worker-run, is that the next phase is far more important. How do we get to there, where the jobs are maintained, or even that the workplaces become democratic in the process of being saved from bankruptcy? Because it's one thing to get one last payout, and spending a week in Detroit, it's devastating how many people are fighting the last great fight of their working lives in order to get another 3 months of what they were owed. What happens after that? So these struggles need to go forward to not just, you know, getting the severance, preserving jobs and creating jobs. Because worker-run enterprises are so much more efficient without CEO salaries, stupid marketing campaigns, and other executive gambling and derivatives and everything else, that worker-run factories and businesses are actually much more profitable and can afford to employ many more people.
And what has happened to the rest of the workers? You say about 10 now have returned to the reopened factory. What about the other 230? How are they faring, or how have they fared in the last few months?
Well, they got a hope, but in the meantime, it's desperate outside. They try to look work and outside, and it's kind of worse because they go through some factories, window factories, including those factories has some former supervisors from Republic, and they knew the workers. So when these workers comes to these factories and ask for employee, they said, you know what? We know you. We know you have experience and all the skills you have. But because the economy is real bad, we can't hire you as the minimum wage. So it's terrible, including the people that know, they know they're treating that way, the workers. And, well, probably it's the economy, but in the meantime, probably they abuse from the workers.
Well, we want to thank you, Armando Robles, for joining us, president of Local 1110 of the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America in Chicago, maintenance worker at the former Republic Windows and Doors factory, and Avi Lewis for bringing this to our attention. When we come back from break, Naomi will come back along with the story of what happened in Argentina, the documentary that Avi and Naomi did called The Take. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to an excerpt of Avi Lewis and Naomi Klein's documentary, The Take, about workers in Argentina taking over factories abandoned by their owners.
Zanon Ceramics. After 2 years under worker control, it's the granddaddy of this new movement. Today, the factory's in production with 300 workers. Decisions are made in assemblies. One worker, one vote. Everyone gets exactly the same salary.
It wasn't always like this. A couple of years ago, the owner claimed that the plant was no longer profitable, that it had to be shut down. The workers refused to accept that fate. They argued that the company owed so much to the community in debts and public subsidies that it now belonged to everyone. In the Menem years, the Zanon factory had received millions in corporate welfare, and the owner still ran up huge debts. Now that his workers have restarted the machines, he's back.
Are you going to get your factory back?
I'm going to get it back.
How are you going to do it?
The government will give it back to me. The government will give it back to me.
That means the workers can never rest. They keep a 24-hour guard at the factory, and everyone's equipped with a slingshot in case the police show up.
Their struggle against authority has even won them fans in one of Argentina's biggest rock bands. Bersuit is in town, and the band is dedicating its show to the workers of Zanon.
The guys in Zanon did. Fighting against the police.
Just marbles.
Like when we were kids with slingshots.
Against real weapons, they took over the factory.
But as we discovered walking down Main Street, Zanon's real weapon is the support of the community.
What do you think of the Zanon plant under worker control?
That it works better than under the former owners.
Because
at least people are working. The tiles are cheaper. And the future is brighter than it was under the owners. All they did was get subsidies from the state, nothing else, and they kept the money for themselves.
All I know is that the community supports them 100%. Because they're not stealing, they're not killing anyone. On the contrary, they're working to feed their families.
There are many companies that should be in the hands of the workers. But it seems that this is not politically convenient. That's the real problem.
And now that we're in production, Mr. Zanon, you can kiss our asses.
What do you think of this slogan of the workers, which is Zanon es del pueblo? Zanon is of the people.
What can I say? It's not true. It's not of the people. The investment was mine. All the work was mine. I put in everything. It can't be of the people.
You are standing in front of $90 million worth of factory, which you and your compañeros have taken over for your own benefit. We have a word for that. It's called stealing.
There's another word.
Expropriation.
And that's
the Zanon workers have gathered thousands of signatures supporting their demand for definitive expropriation. They donate tiles to local hospitals and schools.
And Zanon's community building has paid off. Since the workers' takeover, they've fought off 6 separate eviction orders. Each time, thousands of supporters have flocked to the factory, set up defenses, and been ready to put their bodies between the machines and the police. Each time, the judge's trustees have retreated, leaving the factory under worker control. For now, Zenon really is the property of the people.
An excerpt from the documentary The Take, directed by Avi Lewis and written by Naomi Klein, who are with us today for the hour. We're also joined now by Sergio Ciancaglini, co-author of Sin Patrón, Stories from Argentina's Worker-Run Factories. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Could you tell us what has happened in the factory that you occupied back then, or was occupied back then by the workers that were in this documentary?
Actualmente, las fábricas siguen trabajando.
Today, the factories continue to operate.
Y cada vez mejor.
And better all the time.
Y además hay nuevas fábricas.
And also there are new factories
que están recuperándose.
That are being recovered.
Y hay algo más que está ocurriendo.
And something else is also happening.
Muchas organizaciones, muchos hijos de estas fábricas,
many children of these factories,
están naciendo,
are being born,
con un estilo de trabajo que es horizontal,
with a horizontal work style,
autónomo con respecto a los partidos políticos y al Estado,
separate, completely autonomous of the government and political parties,
y creando un estilo sin patrón, no solo en las fábricas recuperadas, sino en nuevos proyectos productivos.
Creating a bossless model and also new alternatives.
Son proyectos de salud,
of cooperatives, their health cooperative projects, education,
de ropa,
clothing,
de metalúrgicos,
metalworking,
cientos y cientos de fábricas recuperadas y miles y miles de nuevos proyectos cooperativos, solidarios,
that are in solidarity.
Inclusive, por ejemplo, están trabajando mucho con nosotros.
They're also working with us.
La Vaca es una cooperativa.
La Vaca is a cooperative.
Pero, por ejemplo, están trabajando con nosotros en emprendimientos de hospitales psiquiátricos.
They're working with us on projects of psychiatric hospitals.
Y los médicos están descubriendo.
And the doctors are discovering
que el trabajo,
that the job, the work,
ayuda a curar la locura,
to cure insanity.
Sergio, you are a well-known journalist in Argentina.
Un periodista muy conocido en Argentina.
You and your partner quit the corporate media to cover cooperatives like that and be part of a cooperative yourself. How does the media cover this in Argentina?
¿Cómo es que los medios cubren eso en la Argentina?
Los medios no son medios.
The media are not means, not media.
They are not in the medium of nothing. Los periodistas no son periodistas.
Journalists are not journalists.
Y la información
and
no es información.
Is not information.
Es lo que nosotros llamamos
it's
formateo.
What we call formatting.
De cabezas.
Of heads, of minds.
Entonces, la posibilidad para las fábricas o para los nuevos proyectos
the possibility for factories and new projects
es crear nuevas opciones
to create new
de hacer
options
oír su propia voz.
And to make their own voices heard.
I would just, I could just jump in. I first met Sergio in the middle of the craziness in Argentina after the collapse of five governments in 2001. Argentina, if you remember, the huge protests, the cacerolazos, they threw out the president and they cycled through four more presidents in a period of 3 weeks. In this period, when Argentina was really on fire, the protests were, outside the Congress, outside the Plaza de Mayo, but they were also outside the media stations, outside Clarín, outside the radio stations, holding corporate media accountable for the way in which they were distorting the protests. So, and at the same time as you had this popular rebellion across the country, there was also an independent media revolution going on in Argentina. Indie Media Argentina was crucial in this period, and it was really the first time where you saw indie media in an absolutely central role in a national uprising. It was that you went to indie media to find out where the next protest was, to communicate, and La Vaca came out of this period. And I always remember Sergio's partner, Claudia Acuña, who's, a great friend of ours, and really both Sergio and Claudia played a huge role in shaping the vision in The Take and also in my book, in The Shock Doctrine. Claudia saying to me, we interviewed her for the film, and this clip didn't make it into the film, but I always remember what Claudia said. She just couldn't understand how people went to gyms and went on the treadmill because how could they not be in the streets walking and walking and talking to people when the country was, so much was happening in the country, says, I just don't understand those people on treadmills. And that's Claudia and Sergio. They are on the streets just covering the country. It's incredible what they're doing.
Let's ask you, you said that the movement is largely independent or autonomous of political parties, and but what has been the impact of the movement on the government, and how has the government responded to the continuing movement of factory takeovers or workplace takeovers?
El movimiento de fábricas tiene una relación adulta,
has an adult relationship
con quien sea.
With whoever.
La diferencia es que
the
quien decide is that todo es
the
la asamblea.
Person that decides is the assembly. That's who decides.
Y las relaciones con el Estado
in relationship to the state,
son lo que en algún momento los trabajadores definían como
point,
con un Estado bobo.
The workers called it a dumb state.
Un Estado tonto.
A stupid state.
Que no entiende.
That doesn't understand.
Y no le interesa entender.
And is not interested in understanding.
Por su alianza con las empresas.
Because of its alliance with the companies.
La importancia que tienen estos proyectos.
The importance of these projects.
Que son, no sé si son la revolución.
I don't know if you could call them the revolution.
No sé si hay una revolución.
I don't know if there's one single revolution.
Pero yo aprendí que puede haber muchas pequeñas revoluciones.
There can be many small revolutions.
Que cambian la vida de las personas.
That change people's lives.
Que les permiten trabajar,
that allow them to work,
crear nuevas relaciones,
create new
entre
relationships
ellos,
among themselves,
y Democracy Now.
And Democracy Now.
We are doing it.
Last question, we just have 30 seconds. It was the middle class who took to the streets and smashed the windows of banks. Is that movement at all supportive of the takeover of factories?
No entendí. I didn't understand, and I want, it's very important for me to understand it.
Well, since we only have 30 seconds, I'm going to just quickly ask that question to Naomi.
Voy a preguntarle a Naomi.
Well, absolutely. You know, the university students, lots of middle-class people supported the occupied factories.
Excuse me, but I understood something.
Okay.
One thing. The medium class.
Yes.
Is learned about the factories. They began to make assemblies. And now, in all Argentina, you have assemblies fighting against the open mining.
The open mining, open pit mining.
Of course. Yeah. En este momento en Argentina existe cantidad de movimientos.
Today in Argentina there are many movements.
Que tomaron de las fábricas recuperadas.
That of the recovered factories.
We have 5 seconds.
El concepto.
They took the concept, the idea.
De cómo organizarse y cómo combatir.
Organize themselves and how
we leave it there.
En áreas muy distintas.
Thank you very much for joining us. Sergio Ciancaglini and Naomi Klein. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, Democracy in